the Mass for Catholicism. Well, the point is that you begin with simplicity. You go up to a point of complexity where the complexity becomes confusing as the expression of religious ideas, and then you may go back to an extreme simplicity and end up with Zwingli and having no music at all in churches. In art, you have a similar phenomenon. The art of the early church is comparatively simple. In the Middle Ages, with the development of the Gothic, there came the possibility of utilizing large areas of the walls for windows. These were filled with stained glass, which at first had very large areas of primary colors. But in the course of time, painting was imitated, until in the cathedral at Sens, every hair in the beard of the patriarchs is painted. Well, now, for stained glass, that makes no sense, because the window is so far off that the detail cannot be distinguished. Furthermore, the sculpture was so increased that the Cathedral of Milan looks like stalagmites, and it's simply a mass of statues. This over-elaboration occasioned a revolt by St. Bernard, who said they would have no stained glass in the Cistercian churches. They would use only plain, opaque glass. They didn't have transparent glass, but neither did they have big enough pieces to cover the entire window. And even if they had, the wind would have broken it. They had to have some supports. They used lead, but they soon began to introduce patterns into the lead and got most intricate designs of black and white. So from simplicity up to complexity again. The revolt against the over-elaboration of the Gothic comes in the period of the Renaissance, where that style was rejected, and particularly in Italy, a larger use was made of the dome. With the dome, one could not have the elevated windows. The windows were below the edge of the dome, and their primary function now was to bring in light, but the dome could be decorated. The whole of the Sistine Chapel, though it isn't a dome, it's square, but the whole ceiling is decorated by Michelangelo. The great dome at Florence could in similar fashion be decorated. So one got in the dome the expanse of contained space, but within it the possibility of interior decoration. The extreme elaboration of this really doesn't come till the Baroque period, and then again you have a revolt in favor of simplicity. Now, whether you regard this as progress or decline depends a little bit, of course, on what you think is ideal. If you think all music and all art is an impediment to religion, then the utter simplicity is the ideal, and any elaboration is corruption. If you think that these enrich worship, then perhaps the best period could be described in terms of the progress of a plant. First you have the little sprout, and then you have the flower. You regard that as the peak, and then you go to seed. With over-elaboration, and you regard that as degeneration. Well, this is perhaps a more complex phenomenon than I ought to have introduced, but the point is that there's a certain cycle here, a continuous process of change, with periods arising in which there are revolts against what people have come to feel has reached the point where it no longer is an adequate expression of religious emotion, and has become rather a fanfare and a display. It has in it an element of the theatrical and the spectacular. A return to a measure of simplicity is regarded now as preferable. Well, these are some of the rhythms of decline, renewal, for the process of reform has been continual in Christianity. Well, now let us come to the 16th century and ask ourselves where things stood at that time. There were abuses of a great many varieties, so much so that some reformers were in utter despair. There was one preacher in France who said to his audience, "Don't think that the Virgin Mary and John the Baptist will intercede for you. They're fed up." There were reformers who were engaging in vehement denunciation, and quite independently of Luther. Take the phenomenon of Savonarola in Italy, and there was much of which they had a right to complain. I've spoken of clerical celibacy, of concubinage, and it was widespread. It's a little difficult, of course, to get statistics. Some of the Protestant reformers suggested the numbers of concubinous priests, but that's a little hard to pin down. But we do know this, that in Scotland, there were more legitimatizations of the illegitimate children of priests and monks than of the laity. We know that Cardinal Ximenes introduced a drastic program to put an end to clerical and monastic concubinage in Spain. We know that Erasmus speaks of the extent of the evil in his own native Holland, and he says, as far as adultery is concerned, if we were to revive the Old Testament penalty of stoning, we wouldn't have enough mountains to provide the stones. In Switzerland, one of the reformers gave statistics for a certain canton. They're appallingly large. There may have been exaggerations, but at any rate, everybody agreed that this was a drastic evil. Now, there were several things that could be done about it. One was to allow clerical marriage. Another was to introduce a drastic discipline for those who did not keep the rules. And the Council of Trent went in for the second policy. And in some countries, at any rate, very largely with success, the Protestants were to introduce clerical marriage. And, of course, monasticism dropped out of the picture. But the evil was widespread. Then there were financial abuses. One must recognize at this point that the papacy did need money. It was an international institution. And if it had really done what it was supposed to do, it could have been a great blessing to Europe. But it could not very well have an extensive administration, officials of the church checking up on local parishes, dealing with principalities and powers and political units. It couldn't have a bureaucracy without funds from somewhere. And the way to get the money was from the local churches. But people never liked taxation. There was a great deal of resentment against tithes, because on the lands owned by the church, and it had very extensive lands, rents or tithes, if you please, had to be paid to the church, and if they weren't paid, the church's collector came around and took off a cow or a sheep or something else. All of this provoked intense resentment. Indulgences I shall speak of later on as far as their theory is concerned. Suffice it to say that they constituted a very popular way of raising money because they were voluntary. You didn't have to subscribe for an indulgence. So the church made a great deal of this way of raising money, but many other devices were introduced. And particularly in a period when the papacy was in exile from Rome and had its headquarters at Avignon on the edge of southern France. This was for roughly 70 years in the 14th century. during that period, all of the income from Italy was cut off, because normally the church got all of the revenues from its Italian estates. Well, in order to supply the deficiency, Pope John the 22nd, who was the great business genius of the papacy, had recourse to many devices for raising money. One was the sale of offices. Another was to require a bishop to give all of his first year's income to the church. This was called annates. Then, if a bishopric became vacant, the pope would fill it by transferring another bishop, and then another bishop to fill his place, another to fill his place, and you get the first year's income from all of the transfers. Because they'd all be new bishops. And then, because a bishopric was lucrative, prospective candidates were allowed to pay a fee in advance, which would give them a certain lien on the office when it became vacant. And there were first liens, second liens, third, fourth, and fifth liens, down to the point where the chances didn't seem highly probable. These were called reservations. And then there were visitations. the Pope didn't stay in Rome. He would go around and visit various parishes. And while he was there, he and his entire retinue were to be entertained. It became very expensive to entertain the Pope, and there were parishes which were willing to give something less than it would cost to entertain the Pope if he didn't come. So the Pope was able to raise a lot of money by not having visitations. And then there were dispensations. Dispensations to do something irregular in the church. To be a bishop before one was old enough to be a priest. Or for the annulment of a marriage, a declaration that it wasn't a marriage in the first place because some document had been dug up and some impediment had been discovered and so on. There were dispensations, and these all involved fees. And then offices in the papal court, like bishoprics, involved a return of a certain, a huge fee to begin with for the receiving of the office. These were some of the devices which were used for raising money for the international papacy. Now, conceivably, there would not have been so much objection if the money had been spent for purposes which all people regarded as the genuine concern of a Christian institution. But when the Pope was in Avignon, a lot of the money was spent on mercenaries to fight in Italy for the recovery of the estates which were being overrun by native princes. And England and Germany had little disposition to give money to finance papal armies in Italy. And there was a feeling, too, that all Christendom ought not to be mulcted in order to make Rome a beautiful city. There was that feeling with regard to the building of St. Peter's. Why should Germany give money to build a great mausoleum to Peter and Paul in Rome when there wasn't enough money to repair the roofs on local parishes? There's a certain element of national objection here. So the drain on local churches for the papacy occasioned resentment, and the way in which the money was spent was regarded as highly objectionable. And then there were political abuses. The papacy in the period just before the Reformation was something in between an Italian city-state and an international institution. Italy had five great city-states, Venice, Milan, Florence, Naples, and Rome. And the papacy, obviously, was one of them. The popes of the Renaissance were thoroughly secularized. There was not a one among them who was distinguished for the probity of his life or for the depth of his devotion. They were scarcely to be distinguished from the Visconti and the Sforzas and the Borgias and the various other princes of the surrounding Italian city-states. They were magnificent, so also were the despots. They employed the great artists, they made Rome magnificent, and they engaged in political machinations. There was Sixtus IV, for example, who wanted to have the Medici deposed at Florence. And his nephews came in and told him how they had hatched a conspiracy to assassinate them. He said, "There shall be no killing." They said, "Holy Father, leave it to us." And he said, "Io sono contento." I am content. Did he mean he was content to have the killings, or he was content not to be told what was happening? Well, in any case, there was a conspiracy ending in the assassination of Giuliano de' Medici. But Lorenzo escaped, and the conspirators were caught and hanged, including the archbishop who had been involved in the conspiracy. The struggle of the French factions and the Spanish factions in the papacy led to conspiracies and even attempts at assassinations within the Holy Conclave. And Leo X, the Pope who excommunicated Luther, barely got off with his life because of an attempt to poison him by the cardinals. And some of them paid heavily for their indiscretion. Julius II was titanic, magnificent, and a great soldier. Led his own armies. Thomas More said to Henry VIII, "You must remember that the Pope also is a temporal prince." The Pope's engaged in political alliances, even with the Turk, because when the French and the Emperor and the Emperor Charles controlled Germany and Austria, the Netherlands and Spain, when that whole complex and France were pitted against each other, the papacy would side with one or the other, and then one side or the other would make alliances in the East, either with the Persians or the Turks. They were fighting each other over on that side, and the Europeans would make alliances in that direction. And the papacy itself made alliances with the Turks. There's a whole book on the papacy and the Turks in this period. The historian Jakob Burckhardt, in his book on the civilization of the Renaissance in Italy, said that that Luther saved the papacy. That if it hadn't been for Luther, the papacy would very probably have become a secularized Italian city-state and would not have pretended to be the head of Christendom. It was Luther who revived the religious consciousness of the Catholic Church and brought about a drastic change in the character of the papacy itself. Now, of course, one can't know what would have happened if something had happened that didn't happen. But the state of the papacy in that period was, well, to say the least, scandalous. And Pasteur, the great historian of the Catholic historian of the papacy in modern times, said that it was one of the great tragedies of history that when Luther emerged, the Pope was a man who in the early church would not have been regarded as worthy to be an acolyte. There were then moral abuses, financial abuses, and political abuses. There were also religious abuses, and some of these arose out of the survival of the popular paganism of the Middle Ages. The common people regarded religion very largely in terms of magic. They believed that in the Mass, the body of Christ would actually bleed. If you cut the wafer, blood would come from it. The wafer was used for purposes of magic. The story is told. One man who secreted some of the bread in his mouth, the wafer, and took it back and put it in his beehive to increase the amount of honey, whereupon the bees built about it in beeswax a complete Gothic cathedral, and they buzzed a holy litany. Well, I won't vouch for the authenticity of these tales, but at any rate, they indicate what people thought the Mass might do. And then there were questions as to whether if the mouse ate the bread, he was eating the body of God, and so on. The Mass was looked upon as a crudely magical rite. It was believed that God was sacrificed again upon the altar. And you have pictorial representations of a small being representing Christ who is actually being sacrificed. As for pilgrimages, they were extremely popular. Of course, they were good outings. The Canterbury Tales of Chaucer do not give the impression that they were highly devotional exercises. And a good many disorders occurred in connection with these travels to St. James and Compostela or to Jerusalem. As for indulgences, I'll explain the theory later on when I come to Luther. But suffice it to say that they were devices for bargaining with God. I got so many credits, I get so many rewards, and so on and so on. The cult of relics was extremely extensive. It was said that there were enough thorns extant from the crown of thorns to make a whole hedge. And as for the cross of Christ, it had been indefinitely multiplied. But they also had preposterous collections of relics. They had some of the breath of the infant Jesus. Or at least the satirists claimed that they did. Joseph's slippers and Mary's hair and Mary's milk. Erasmus saw some of Mary's milk at the shrine of Walsingham. He said it looked to him like chalk. There was a certain amount of fakery with regard to all of this. But pilgrimages, relics, the Mass, the cult of the saints. There was a particular saint for each particular disease. Saint Roche was able to help you out in the plague. I've forgotten now the saint who took charge of the toothache. But anyway, there was one especially for the toothache. And of course, for gout and leprosy and all particular diseases. And one of them took charge of lost articles. Saint Anthony looked after the pigs. And there was Saint Januarius in Naples, whose powdered blood would liquefy annually on a particular date, and still does. They had it a few weeks ago. All Naples gathers and waits breathlessly for the announcement that the blood is liquefied. And if the saint is a little slow in performing the miracle, they begin to curse the saint. Well, it was reported in the papers only 2 or 3 weeks ago that the blood liquefied on pretty close to the scheduled time. Well, as a matter of fact, there was a pagan god in Naples whose blood performed this miracle. The saints became the successors of the gods. There's a book, Les Saints, les successeurs des dieux. The names were changed, the functions remained. Here, then, were many of the popular superstitions of the religion of the common folk. As for their knowledge in the way of biblical matters, it was rather minimal. They were all expected to know the Ten Commandments and the Lord's Prayer. It wasn't required that they should know that the Ten Commandments were in the Old Testament and the Lord's Prayer in the New, so long as they could say them. And the Apostles' Creed was also regarded as a staple, and catechisms were built about these three. Now, the common people did know more about Christianity than these three items. There were various ways in which they had been educated in the Middle Ages, to be sure. One, of course, was the cathedral with the stained glass windows in which one had pictures illustrating the great events of the Old and the New Testament. But how many people ever saw a cathedral? They were only in the cities and in the villages. The people might never in their whole lives go more than 5 miles away from the place where they were born. They didn't see all this. There were also dramatic representations in the church, and we know about the mystery plays and the Noah cycle and the nativity cycle and so on. And those may have been performed in local churches. We do have a record of some boys who decided to put on a miracle play of their own, and they were going to hang Haman. And they got one of the boys on a box, and they had the rope above him, put it around his neck, and somebody accidentally kicked the box. And if somebody hadn't been quick, they might have hanged him in reality. But the main point is that children knew enough about it to put on a little miracle play of their own. So perhaps the drama served to educate the people, even in the local communities. There was preaching, of course, but it wasn't very extensive. The Franciscans, because the parish priest neglected preaching, did go out into the hamlets. But even so, there was continual complaint of the inadequacy of preaching. Of course, there were no books. In the 14th to 15th centuries, they began, however, to use block books. Block books have a woodcut, and then the written part of it is done by hand on the rest of the page. I suppose they could have cut the letters in the block too and stamped the entire page, but it was not movable type. These block books were called the Bibles of the Poor, Biblio Pauperum. They had a stereotyped arrangement because in the center of the page they had a theme from the New Testament and flanked by two themes with a parallel idea from the Old Testament. This is the way in which they linked the two dispensations. Jesus goes down into the grave, Joseph goes down the well, and Jonah goes down the whale. Adam is tempted by, Jesus is tempted by the devil in the wilderness. Adam and Eve are tempted by the serpent in paradise, and Joseph is tempted by Potiphar's wife. So they get these parallels all the way through. For the resurrection, they didn't quite carry out the same theme as going into the grave, because there, Jesus comes out of the tomb, and Jonah comes out of the whale. And incidentally, the artists had a big problem there because they wanted him to come out head first, but their whales weren't big enough for him to turn around in. And the problem was, how if he went in head first, they could get him out head first. So some of them solved this problem by having him go in feet first. But this is a minor detail. Jesus came out of the tomb and Jonah came out of the whale, but they didn't have Joseph coming out of the well. They had Samson carrying off the gates of the city as Christ triumphed over hell. But the main point is that this was popular education. These block books, they were not very widely circulated. And as a matter of fact, I think it's a question whether the Reformation could ever have succeeded without printing. It was this which disseminated the Bible. The people then were addicted to popular superstitions, and the facilities at hand for their education were distinctly restricted. As for monasticism, it had largely outlived its function. The monks weren't outrageously bad, but they were not distinguished for piety or for service to society. Possibly it's the cities which deprived the monks of their utility. Monasticism was adapted to an agrarian culture where the monks cultivated a piece of land and radiated out over the countryside. But with the rise of the cities, they no longer served the same function. Father David Knowles has written a history of monasticism in England. He's obviously a Catholic. He says that in the 200 years before the Reformation, the monasteries had not been distinguished either for piety or for learning, but rather just for mediocrity. He feels himself that monasticism had largely outlived its function. And the new monastic orders of Catholicism after the Reformation have had a changed character. They have usually been founded to achieve a specific objective in a particular setting, to care for lepers, for example, or to go on a particular mission and so on. They're all they're not contemplative, but active movements and directed toward the achievement of particular ends. Monasticism didn't cease in Catholicism, but it changed its character after the Reformation. Well, here then is something of the picture as it was in the beginning of the 16th century. Now, Lucas was not the first reform. There had been a series of attempts for about 300 years earlier to correct these various abuses. In fact, the great Gregorian reform of the papacy was an attempt to purify the church and to Christianize the whole of society. But as we have already indicated, some of its reforms misfired. And when that happened, there were smaller groups who said, if the church as a whole and society as a whole cannot be reformed, then smaller groups should go ahead on their own, regardless of others, and try to set up cells, if you like, or units, which within their own community will exemplify Christian ideals and practice. And we have a great resurgence of sectarianism from about the 12th century on. It's a strange phenomenon in church history that you have many sects in the first 400 years. The early church was not a period of church unity. Many sects. Epiphanius said that in the time of Constantine there were 80 Christian denominations or sects or varieties. But in the Middle Ages, from the beginning of the barbarian invasions down to about the 12th century, you don't have any divisions. It may be because Christian energies were so far taken up with converting the barbarians. It may have been the monasticism provided an outlet for variety. There was so little intellectual life that there was no intellectual heresy. In six centuries, you could pick out a heretic for a century about on theological grounds. Now, of course, they might have quarreled about something else, but there are no major splits. until we get down to about the 12th century, and then southern France and northern Italy begin to swarm with heretical and sectarian groups. That's why the Inquisition was instituted, to try to suppress them. The church, when it had the greatest power, began to crack, and then had recourse to suppression. These groups had various emphases. There were the Valdenses. This was a lay movement, a vernacular movement, a movement in favor of popular preaching. Waldo, the leader of that movement, was a rich merchant of Lyon. He was converted in 1176. He then gave his goods to the poor. The church didn't object to that. But then he engaged a priest to translate parts of the scripture for him into Italian, and he couldn't read, but he just memorized them and went around reciting them to anybody he got a hold of and putting little homilies along with him. He was a preacher. The bishop objected because he wasn't trained. Some of Waldo's followers went to Rome and appealed to the Pope. And they were given an examination. Do you believe in God the Father Almighty? Yes. Do you believe in Jesus Christ, his only Son, our Lord? Yes. Do you believe in the Virgin Mary, the Mother of Christ? Yes. You're a heretic. She's the Mother of God, not the Mother of Christ. To use the expression Mother of Christ instead of Mother of God was claimed to be a revival of the old heresy of Nestorius, who said that Mary was only the mother of the human nature of Christ. So the Pope refused them permission. Or rather, he said it was contingent upon the consent of local bishops, and local bishops wouldn't give it, so they went ahead anyway. And then the church started repression. They took refuge in northern Italy from France and went up to the highest reaches of the Alps, where they survived to this very day. Their dialect became different. They're in the area of Piedmont and Torino. Agape is one of their koinonia establishments, if you please. After religious liberty came in Italy, they began to spread down into the Italian cities, and there are Valdensian churches all over Italy at the present time. Quite a number of them came to America. Some of them had their expenses paid by the Mormons. I don't think they quite knew what they were getting in for, but some of them have gone in with the Mormons. They had a colony in Valdez in North Carolina, I think it is. It still has that name. And in my student days, there was a Valdensian church in New Haven, Connecticut. I worked with that church for 4 years in my student days, picked up Italian in that way. So this is a pre-Reformation non-Roman sect surviving into modern times. But it has not succeeded in converting all Italy to its position. It has held its ground as a minority sect, making a witness, a protest, and having some effect upon Catholicism in Italy. Then there were a great many more. I could rattle off half a dozen or so names. It wouldn't mean too much except to illustrate the point that revolt was rife. The Paterini, the Tisserand, the Umiliati, the Petrobrusiani, the Ardondelisti, and so on and so on. They may have had some trade connections, because the Paterini were papermakers and the Tisserand were weavers. This suggests a certain connection between the guilds and the dissemination of ideas in the cities, which were, as I said, beginning to revive in this period. At any rate, they were numerous. And then there were the Albigenses. They were quite definitely anti-Christian. Disillusioned crusaders returning through Bulgaria picked up the heresy of the Albigenses, who claimed that the body is so drastically evil that it's a crime to imprison any more souls in bodies, and so they objected to the perpetuation of the human race. Though they divided into the perfect and the sub-perfect, and the sub-perfect continued to have children, so maybe if they had been victorious, they wouldn't have exterminated the human race. But anyway, this group, well, it claimed to be Christian. It made use of John's Gospel in particular because of the emphasis on the Spirit. It had rites corresponding to baptism and the Lord's Supper, but it rejected the whole hierarchy and all of the sacramental practices of the Catholic Church. It wouldn't have anything to do with anything material, of course not, bread and wine in the sacrament, and certainly not the cross. That's material. and so on. The church launched a crusade against this sect, and people came down from northern France to wipe out the Albigenses, and then France annexed their whole territory, and then the Inquisition cleaned up on the remnants. So you've got definitely Christian sects with a strong moralistic, lay, and vernacular emphasis in the Valdenses and related ones, and some which from any point of view are to be regarded as, at least in part, definitely non-Christian, the Albigenses. Then later on you get movements which have also a tinge of nationalism, namely that of the Bohemians, John Huss and the whole Hussite movement, which again survives to this day. And John Huss has become quite popular with the communists because he was burned by the Catholic Church. They had a great movie in Bohemia on the whole Huss story, and they play up all the corruptions of the Catholic Church and its cruelties, and play up John Huss as the great anti-Catholic, forgetting that he's not exactly a communist. Part of the Hussite movement joined up with Zinzendorf in the Moravian Church and founded Bethlehem, Pennsylvania. So this Moravian Church traces its ancestry both to Germany and Zinzendorf and to Bohemia and John Huss. There was a crusade against the Bohemians, but they were not exterminated. They fought back. And in the end, religious pluralism was allowed in Bohemia before the Reformation, and the more moderate Hussites were tolerated. There were more extreme Hussites who introduced communism. One party was completely pacifist, but the main group differed with the Catholic Church primarily only on the point of giving the cup to the laity in the Mass. And that was a rather minor point, and they were tolerated. Then in England, there was the revolt of John Wycliffe, and here there's a tinge of English feeling against the papacy, particularly because that was the period when the papacy was at Avignon in southern France. But Wycliffe had drastic criticisms of the church. He died in bed because of political protection, but his followers, called Lollards, were subjected to the penalties of burning. Sir John Falstaff, of whom Shakespeare makes a character, was actually a leader among the Lollards. The movement was very largely suppressed, but of late studies have been made of various localities where Lollardry was once strong, and it has been discovered that there was an actual continuity from the late 14th century down to the 16th. And Protestantism took hold in some of the sections where Lollardry still survived. There is an historian named Dickens, now at Cambridge, who, together with his pupils, has been going through documents, particularly wills, and finding references to the religious opinions of the testator. And they discover a certain continuity of Lollardry. But as a public movement, it was suppressed in England, though it left a residue which filters down into the English Reformation. Now, Huss was Bohemian, and he resented Romanism because Romanism had come into Bohemia via Germany, and the Czech anti-German feeling entered into the picture. And Wycliffe was a staunch Englishman. But now, both of these made new translations of the scriptures. And the Wycliffeite version goes right down into Tyndale and all of the subsequent translations. We have in the Yale Library a copy of Wycliffe's translation, or done by his associates, a copy transcribed in the year 1380. I find that it's quite easy to read. Of course, you have to get used to the symbols because they use particular characters for TH and for G and GH, but you get used to that and it makes it very simple. As for the word forms, of course, it's Chaucer's English, but it's not difficult. That translation, as I say, goes right straight down through the long succession, but there's no printing press, and there was no printing press for Huss. There was another movement within the Catholic Church of reform, namely conciliarism, because for a time there was a split in the papacy with two popes, And in order to correct this, they had a whole series of church councils, and they tried to turn the church into a constitutional monarchy and to bring about a great many reforms. But they found that for an ecclesiastical council, without the support of the constituency, to draw up a draft on reforms didn't get anywhere. And by the time of the Reformation, the idea of an appeal to a church council was still very live, and Luther appealed to a council still to come. But the councils did not succeed in correcting the abuses. There were also movements of a very genuine and devout piety, the Brethren of the Common Life, among whom Erasmus was trained. But they just sort of, well, were rather despairing about the church as a whole, and felt the thing to do was to cultivate the interior life and to care for one's neighbor with humility and sincerity. They were not revolutionary-minded. In the early 16th century, there was a period of comparative latitude because the medieval heresies and sects had been crushed. And in Spain, the Jews had been expelled and the Moors had been conquered. The church felt secure, and it allowed criticism, and it allowed discussion. And in this period, there arose in Europe a movement which is now called evangelism. Now, that's the French word, but it meant a return to the gospel. Erasmus was one of its great representatives, and the ideal was to recover the purity of the primitive church, and also the political concepts of justice and magnanimity that had characterized the Roman Empire at its best. This movement had representatives in England with More and Colet, in France with Lefebvre, in Spain with Ximenes, in Italy with Valdez, and a whole circle of high-minded men in the Oratorio del Divino Amore, the Oratory of Divine Love, it was called. We're not to think of everybody in the 16th century as being a rogue or indifferent to religion. There never would have been a Reformation if there had not been a great many people who were profoundly disturbed and desirous of bringing about reform. But how was it to be done? Some believe that this movement of evangelism, return to the gospel, if Luther hadn't emerged, would have gradually corrected the abuses, that the Church of Rome would not have been split, that the unity of Christendom might have been maintained, that there would have been no wars of religion. Could it have been? Or was some drastic revolutionary movement required? And was there a certain inevitability in the drift from persuasion to violence? It's the dilemma of our own generation with a new set of problems. That, then, is the background of the situation when we come to Luther and the emergence of the Protestant Reformation. And I'll go on with that next time.